You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, broadcasting at 99.3 FM and streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with author and journalist Elizabeth Day, whose book The Party came out here in the U.S. in August by Little Brown. It's her fourth novel. She lives in the U.K. Her debut novel, Scissors, Paper, Stone, won a Betty Trask Award. Her follow-up, Home Fires, was an Observer Book of the Year. Her third, Paradise City, was named one of the best novels of 2015 in The Observer, Paste Magazine, and The Evening Standard, and was People Magazine's Book of the Week. She's a feature writer for numerous publications in the UK and US, including The Telegraph, The Times, The Guardian, The Observer, Vogue, Grazia, The Radio Times, Elle, Marie Claire, Glamour, InStyle, The Lonely Planet Magazine, The Pool, and Cosmopolitan. She's a contributing editor for Harper's Bazaar. A versatile and wide-ranging writer, her work incorporates everything from celebrity interviews to crime reportage. Elizabeth grew up in Northern Ireland, and her first job was for the Derry Journal. Since then, she has worked for the Evening Standard, the Sunday Telegraph, the Mail on Sunday, and the Observer, where she was staff feature writer for 8 years. She won a British Press Award in 2004 for Young Journalist of the Year and was highly commended as Feature Writer of the Year in 2013. She's the co-founder of Pin Drop, a live performance short story studio, and a regular contributor to Sky News and BBC Radio 4. Here's some information about her new novel, The Party. Martin Gilmore is an outsider. When he wins a scholarship to Burtonbury School, he doesn't wear the right clothes or speak with the right kind of accent. But then he meets the dazzling, popular, and wealthy Ben Fitzmaurice and gains admission to an exclusive world. Soon Martin is enjoying tennis parties and Easter egg hunts at the Fitzmaurice family's estate as Ben becomes the brother he never had. But Martin has a secret. He knows something about Ben, something he will never tell. It is a secret that will bind the two of them together for the best part of 25 years. At Ben's 40th birthday party, the great and the good of British society are gathering to celebrate in a haze of champagne, drugs, and glamour. Amid the hundreds of guests, the politicians, the celebrities, the old money, and the newly rich, Martin once again feels that disturbing pang of not quite belonging. His wife, Lucy, has her reservations, too. There is disquiet in the air, but Ben wouldn't do anything to damage their friendship. Would he? When I spoke with Elizabeth Day, I began by asking if the main event of the book, the actual party to which the title refers, was there from the start, as she wrote, or if she began with some other aspect of the book and found the party as the plot unfolded. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I did actually start with the party. And the reason I started with it was because I'd actually begun to write something completely different, a completely different novel. And it was a novel based on my time in Northern Ireland as a young girl in the 1990s when I grew up surrounded by bombs and terrorism. And I had written 40,000 words of this book, and it was just quite dispiriting. And it didn't seem to be flowing that well. It felt like I was having to winch every sentence up from a great sort of subterranean depth. And I just thought, I'm going to put that to one side. And I remember I was in a cafe in London, and I just got too depressed at the thought of soldiering on with this other novel. And I had this very vivid notion that I wanted to write about something fun and glamorous. And I wanted to write about a party. And the best parties I've been to have always been the ones thrown by exceptionally rich people because there's lots of free-flowing champagne and cocktails. And so that's why I started writing about that particular party. And because I was writing about something fun and glamorous, I wanted to be able to write about it from the point of view of an outsider, because then you're able as an author to observe a lot more and to really observe all this kind of excess and this kind of heady whirl. And right. That's how the voice of Martin came to me, was that I mean the first thing I wrote literally was him arriving at the party, and from that point his character grew and so did the plot.
So you started with the party and you found Martin, but how much did you know about the plot? Like, did you know what was going to happen at the party, or did that come as you wrote?
That's such a good question. Because generally, when I start writing, the most important thing for me is to be writing something I'm interested in and to get a character's voice. And actually, when I start, I don't know where the book is going. So when I started writing him arriving at the party, his voice came to me quite automatically. And for those of you that have read the book, you'll probably find that rather shocking, because he's quite a sinister character.
He is,
he's got
yeah.
mild sociopathic tendencies. And I hope I'm not a sociopath. But for some reason, there was something about his voice that just really fitted and flowed. And because his voice needs explaining, because he is this, he's an observer, and his observations are sometimes tinged with a combination of bitterness and love. And I found that really interesting. And then I was like, I need to explain where this comes from. Where does it come from? And from that point, I started thinking quite carefully about Martin's friendship with Ben. And I knew that it was a friendship that was quite one-sided, and that something had to have happened in the past for them still to be friends in the present that would have bound them together, and that this incident would have been riven with tension and need discovery through the course of the text. So once I'd written the first chapter, I then went away and I felt like I've got Martin's voice, and now I can think of the plot. And yeah. Then I went away and thought genuinely about what would happen when.
Okay. And you mentioned a minute ago that you wanted to write from the point of view of an outsider. And I had a question about that. He definitely is an outsider. Martin doesn't feel like he fits in. And you give us a wonderful background on his life that helps us understand, you know, how he came to be who he is. So I wonder, why do you think readers are attracted to an outsider? Why do we find ourselves drawn to a narrator who doesn't fit in?
Well, I, by the way, count myself as one of those readers. I'm obsessed with unreliable narrators. And I think it starts from the very sort of simple point that an observer stands in for you as the reader, because you're arriving at a novel in the same way that Martin's arriving at a party. You need to be introduced by the author to all of the characters / guests, and you need to have the event described to you. And so in that respect, it's a way in for the reader. And I think also there's something about an unreliable narrator that is profoundly satisfying for a reader, because it involves you in a way that you wouldn't be involved otherwise. So the whole way through the party, Martin is saying things that he believes have happened, and you are then given a counterpoint to what his belief is with the voice of Lucy, his wife. And sometimes what she says directly contradicts what he thinks has happened. And I like the fact that as a reader, you can then put together the puzzle of this mystery in your own head. And I hope that that adds to the ratcheting up of tension through the course of the novel. So the party has been described as a psychological thriller.
Yeah.
But I would say, and I'm really happy with that description, but I think that the psychology comes just as much from putting together the facets of character as it does from what happens in the plot and the dramatic incidents that happen in the plot. So I think for those two reasons, we're really interested in observers. And it's got such a long and noble history as well. I mean, I consciously pay tribute in my book to other observers in literature, such as Dickie Greenleaf. Oh my God, the Talented Mr. Ripley. Tom Ripley is a Talented Mr. Ripley. Sorry, brain freeze there. And L.P. Hartley's The Go-Between. And I remember one of the first unreliable narrators I was introduced to was the narrator in Wuthering Heights. I studied that as an English text at school. So yeah. All of those were key influences.
What about, and he's not an unreliable narrator, but he is sort of an outsider to the group that he finds himself in, and that's Nick in The Great Gatsby, observing another huge party, or several of them. Mm. Did you think of Gatsby at all as you were developing the more contemporary storyline of this wealth and opulence and the party situation?
I did. I thought of Gatsby. So I read The Great Gatsby many years ago, and I also read Brideshead Revisited many years ago, and I loved those two books. But I'm one of those readers. I read a book, I know that I love it, and then I can't remember anything about the plot. when I put it aside, that's sort of it. That's like, I remember a feeling it left me with and like a few key phrases. I would love to be someone with a photographic memory. So I had a sense from those two books of atmosphere, really.
Right.
And I remember The Great Gatsby. I just think Fitzgerald is the most incredible prose stylist. And I remember there was one specific paragraph where he describes the party and the drink becomes a verb. So he talks about alcohol sort of flowing through the evening.
Right.
And there was one particular passage that I wrote in the party that was specifically a tribute to that, to the sort of free-flowing nature of alcohol at this kind of party and how it dizzies and numbs and heightens your senses all at the same time. So that was the way... That was the influence I took from it, and it is an enormous privilege even to be mentioned in the same breath as that novel, because I just think it's an exquisite piece of work.
Yeah. Let's see. I wanted to... Well, so let me just mention, I'm not going to give anything away because that's just a horrible thing to do in an interview. But there is a massive event that takes place at this party, and there is an investigation into the event. So I'll go that far. So the narrative moves between the perspective of Martin, sort of generally, and his past, and then Martin at the party and Martin's interrogation, because he's one of the people that's talked to by the police, and then Lucy, who keeps... notebooks of her perspective on everything. And so I'm wondering how that was for you to move through these different narratives. And did you have a certain one that you most enjoyed when you would get to it and go like, oh, good, here I am, Martin at the party, or oh, good, it's Lucy's notebook.
Yes. That's so funny. It was tricky to answer your question because just going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, I had Martin's voice and I had the party, but the voice of Lucy was actually a later addition. I had written four chapters solely from Martin's perspective, and I envisaged the book as being solely from his perspective. And then my wonderful UK editor, who has worked with me on all of my books, just said, you know, I think we need someone who can convey to the reader why Martin deserves our sympathy and our support, because at the moment, he just sounds a little bit creepy.
Yeah.
and it was a brilliant point. And so I went away and I wrote Lucy and introduced her as a major character. And when I started writing Lucy, I was a bit resentful that I had to do this extra work. So I thought, I'm going to write her in a way that is unwritten. I'm going to write her in a way that is straightforward and just like the woman's voice I have in my own head.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, Lucy's voice came to me really easily. It was uncomplicated and unflorid, because Martin sort of prides himself on his ability to describe things. He's an art critic, so
right.
Many of his observations are sort of very well described and slightly acerbic, whereas Lucy's just much more to the point. Some of her experiences are mine. It's not giving anything away to say that she has a miscarriage, and I experienced that, and it was very cathartic to be able to write about it. So Lucy, I enjoyed writing Lucy, but I have to say I did love getting back to Martin at the party. There is nothing better from my perspective as an author than writing about the lifestyles of the rich and famous. It's just so much fun. my previous novel, Paradise City, had at its core a multi-millionaire businessman. And again, I just found it really fun writing about chauffeur-driven cars and people who arrive places in helicopters. So I enjoyed both of those aspects, actually.
Well, and actually, that one thing that I thought you did really well, you know, I understand that women can write men well and men can write women well, but I thought you really were very convincing about writing about boys in boarding school. And I thought, even if you went to boarding school, perhaps having that perspective of an all-boys school was pretty impressive to me. And I wondered what you were drawing on for that.
Thank you so much. That means a lot to me. I did go to boarding school myself. And I've always liked writing in different genders. because ultimately, just to spat a massive cliche, I think we're all just people, and we all get too hung up on our differences, and actually a lot of the time our impetus for actions are the same. But writing in the guise of a teenage boy, I did put in a lot of my own boarding school experiences, but I also ran the specific passages past friends of mine, male friends of mine, who had been to boys' boarding school, just to check that I was on the right track.
Okay.
And one of them did say to me, "Oh my gosh, it's like you have described my first day at school. I don't know how you've done that." I don't know. I remember one of my friends saying that he was at Winchester, which is quite a famous boys' boarding school in the UK, and he was talking to me about the language that teenage boys use, and he was like, "You know, it was this baffling thing, and there was this whole new lexicon where you would say, if you liked a girl and you thought that she was attractive, you would call her fit. But if you said fit with a slightly different inflection, and if you said foot, it meant completely the opposite, that she wasn't worthy of your attention." I was like, oh my gosh, because that's the kind of insight. I mean, I can completely imagine that. And I just imagine someone, you know, who hasn't grown up in that society, who is there like Martin on the scholarship, just being so baffled by all the new rules, but also the fact that there's an entirely new language. So right. I sort of really tapped into that as well. But there's a rugby scene as well. And I've never played rugby. So I was like, I hope I've got this right. so far no one has complained. So that's good.
Well, I think with rugby, you just have to make it really violent. And you got that.
Exactly. So. And a mouth guard. You just put a mouth guard in there and then you're done.
You're done. That's it. Now, the timeline in the book moves through time in sort of present day and in flashback, and there are various levels of flashback. So how did you find that?
That was complicated, actually. I was very concerned with this novel to ensure that the plot really hung together as tightly as it could. It was the first time I'd written a psychological thriller.
Right.
And really, you have to make the plot completely watertight for that to be carried off. And so when I started writing, I started with the characters, and then I came up with the police interview structure. So just to explain to your listeners, most chapters open with a police interview where Martin is being questioned about what has happened at the party 3 weeks before.
Right.
And then each chapter takes you through a flashback period of the party itself, and then goes further back into Martin's past, and then that's interspersed, as you've rightly said, with Lucy's notebook from the same event. And it was quite hard balancing all of that. And the way that I did it was I got a roll of paper and I sort of unrolled it, and I just visually, I did a kind of graph of what happened in each chapter. It was like a sort of chart. And I used color-coded pens for each voice. So I had Martin in red, and I had Lucy in blue, and then I had the stuff that happened in black. And in each box, I then had this visual representation of what happened in each chapter. And because the colors are different, I could see whether it was evenly weighted through the course of the book. And that really, really helped.
Okay.
And then I think, actually, it was a question of not getting too hung up on it, because Martin, I write in the first person, yep. And I write Lucy in the first person too. And I wasn't sure if that was allowed, if you could have two first person narrators. And I wasn't sure what the rules of fiction were. But actually, I think you can do anything as an author, as long as you do it with heart and with intent and with conviction. And so then I was like, yeah, I've got the plot structure, but I'm just going to write it. And you need to be able to give yourself that freedom, I think, as a writer.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you mentioned the interrogations. And did you do research on how the police work that stuff? Or did you just sort of have a sense of it from things that you've read? Or I don't know.
I did research in that I watched a lot of police drama on television. So I love a police procedural. And there is one in Britain called Scott and Bailey, and also one called Happy Valley that I know has made it over the pond, which I completely love.
Yeah.
But Scott and Bailey is absolutely brilliant for the minutiae of day-to-day detective work. It really is. It was one of the first TV programs I'd seen that really examined the process of the interview. And just little things like how often a detective will use someone's first name to try and lull them into a false sense of security and things like that. So I did watch a lot of police drama. I also watched The Affair, the HBO HBO or Showtime show, that drama with Ruth Wilson and Dominic West, because that has a similar structure to The Party. It opens up with, I think it opens up with a police interview, and then you see two sides of the same event in the past leading up to that point. And it was a structure that really interested me. And then when I came to writing the interrogation scenes, there were a few points where I actually needed to, get my Google on. And I was like, how exactly would this be phrased? And Google is just such an incredible resource. And I basically ended up finding some original transcripts of police interviews. It was actually from the Jimmy Savile case in Britain, which was the case of this notorious paedophile TV presenter who died a few years ago, and a lot of the transcripts of his interviews are online. So I use some of those for research as well.
Okay, that's great. So we have talked a little bit about the timeline moving around, the narrative moving around. There's also a blend of past and present tense in the novel, which I wondered if you could talk about. And then I wondered if you could also talk about just keeping track of everything. And I know you say you had that chart, so that must have helped. Yeah. But was there anything else that you did to keep track of where you were and who you were with and what had happened?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I write chronologically. So I write from the beginning of a novel and end up at the end as the reader reads it. And I know not all writers do that, especially not when you have a novel that has different voices. So some writers prefer to write everything from one character's perspective, then everything from the other character's perspective, and then mix the two. But I think it helps me to keep things clear in my own head,
right,
to do it very chronologically. So that was one thing. The second thing that I do is that every time I sit down to write fiction, because I'm also a journalist in my day job, but every time I sit down to write fiction, I will write 1,000 words, and that's my deal with myself. It's not too little and it's not too much, and it doesn't feel overwhelming. And sometimes those 1,000 words will be terrible, and sometimes they'll be okay. But every time I sit down and open up my laptop, I will reread the words that I wrote the day before. And that, again, was very centering and enabled me to get back into the narrative. And then the past and present tense thing, it's so interesting that, because there is a blend of tenses and I never realise that I'm doing it. When I write, I sometimes, it's only in the rereading that I realise I've switched tenses. And I'm like, why did I do that?
Yeah.
Why did I do that? And sometimes I will have to just go back and just make it more more coherent. And again, my editor, Helen, is brilliant at pointing out passages where I've suddenly slipped from past into present. And but I think where it works and why it happens automatically is that I think the present tense is a wonderful gift for conveying immediacy and pace and sometimes panic. And there are a few episodes in The Party that encapsulate those feelings where I use the present because I want it to feel just vivid and visceral.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I do it. But again, I think tenses are something that they don't get a lot of airplay. And actually, as a writer, it's like one of the tools of your kit, and you can have as much fun with them as you can with characterization or plot. And when I wrote my very first novel, Scissors, Paper, Stone, I, again, wasn't sure whether I was allowed, just going back to the quote-unquote rules again, I wasn't sure whether I was allowed to switch tenses between paragraphs. And I actually went back to one of my favourite authors, who's a woman called Elizabeth Jane Howard, who is a wonderful, she's sort of Britain's Anne Tyler, I would say.
Oh, okay.
And she's a wonderful observer of human behavior, had the misfortune to be married to Kingsley Amis, who overshadowed her reputation somewhat because she's also Martin Amis's stepmother. I know, but she's brilliant and I counsel everyone to read her. And okay. I went back and I read her and I was like, how did she do these multiple viewpoints and how does she use tenses? And she really, her writing taught me that it was okay to shift viewpoints and shift tenses. Again, as long as you did it with conviction. Did that answer that question?
Yeah,
I've never
absolutely.
Been asked that before. It was a really good one.
Oh, good. And actually, I have another question about tense, but before I get there, I wanted... Yeah. So your first book was Scissors, Paper, Stone.
Yeah.
So is that what they call it in the UK?
yes, they do. Because I know it's rock, paper, scissors.
It's rock, paper, scissors. I mean, really, that's what's correct, is rock, paper, scissors.
I bet you're going to say it's also correct to spell favourite without a U and call the pavement a sidewalk. Yes, well, funnily enough, Scissors, Paper, Stone is one of my novels that has never been published in America or Canada, so maybe that's why.
All they have to do is change the title. It'll be just fine.
Yeah.
All right. This has a little bit to do with tense, but also it has to do with Martin's mother, who is this odd, wonderfully written character, not very motherly. And I particularly love this one moment very early in the novel. Do you mind if I just read a few sentences?
No, please do.
All right, so Martin is in the police station. I glance upwards to the ceiling, hoping to find something of interest there. In one corner, there is a hairline crack. A childhood memory comes to me unbidden, my mother washing my hair in the bath, as I, hating every second, fixed my gaze on a crack in the yellowing ceiling, willing it to be over. I really loved that. I loved how the crack leads him into this memory. I am always very taken with the way that people use objects or visual prompts to get into a memory. But I also just thought that the tense was really great because it is the past tense, that moment, that childhood memory. And I hating every second, fixed my gaze, although only a second before we're in the police station and it's all present. So I just thought that was very well done. Introduces his mother in this wonderful sort of just kind of not pleasant way.
Oh, thank you so much. Again, I hadn't really noticed that I was doing something with tenses there, but it is so interesting that you have picked that one point from the entire book because I also love it. And the reason being is that one of my earliest memories is of having my hair washed, and I hated having my hair washed, and I hated baths. And I find that so weird now because I like nothing more than having a bath. And I remember my mother washing my hair and looking up to the ceiling and seeing this crack in our bathroom ceiling. And I must have been about three, genuinely. And the crack just being, I just associating that with the act of hair washing. And I do think as a person and as a writer, I think very visually. And therefore, I do think using that kind of flash of visual memory can be so incredibly evocative and can get you somewhere very quickly, as you point out, in the past there. I love that kind of writing where something is happening in the present, but actually in someone's head they're reminded of a defining episode from their past. Thank you for reading that.
Yeah, and I don't think that you did it, but it's also possible to have the crack bring you back into the interrogation room. I don't believe you did that in this case, but, you know, using some sort of visual helps us step between these different dimensions of time and place and memory. And let's see. I have a question later that I will mention this again at that point. But do you mind if I read another little bit?
No, I'm loving it. Thank you.
Oh, good. So here's a description of Martin's mother as he goes to boarding school. My mother did not wait to see me off. She stood on the platform and watched me take my seat. I glanced at her through the window, a broad woman in a shapeless beige coat buttoned all the way up to her neck. Her face was set. I raised a hand halfway to the window. I was going to wave, but then didn't. I thought it might, for some reason, make her cross. She gave a little nod of acknowledgement, then turned and walked away, the low heel of her shoes sounding dully against the concrete. In reading a bit about your work, I found a lot of people who really were very taken with your descriptions of people, and I found that too as I was reading this book. And there's just so much that's going on in this one. You know, I said she wasn't very motherly, but, you know, she has some reasons of her own to feel like perhaps he's not somebody she wants to spend her time with. But it's just, I mean, that's just such a not motherly moment. And you can see, you feel both sympathy for him and then some concern or sympathy for her. It's just so well done. I don't know that I have a question.
Thank you so much. That is completely lovely of you. And I do think that those small, they're seemingly small interactions. It's a moment at a train station, but it conveys hopefully so much more, because actually he's getting that train to go to boarding school and they're not going to see each other for months. And the thought that it might make her cross for him to show vulnerability. And why would she be cross? And is she being cross because it's hiding her own emotion? And why has she buried her own emotion so deeply? And what does that mean to the relationship between the two of them? And he's an only child, and there's no father on the scene. You find out why. And I do think that there's a relationship between single mothers and only children that by necessity is really intense, because for a long period of time, you have only each other.
Right.
And that intensity can be wonderful, and it can also spin out the other way and be claustrophobic. And that was really something I wanted to explore with Martin and his mother.
Yeah. One more thing about that passage, and I think I'm reading too much into it, but she's in this shapeless beige coat. And the police detective who interviews him is somebody he constantly describes as having beige hair. And it just made me wonder, like, are we supposed to make that very subliminal connection between his mother and this woman and her beigeness? You know?
I mean, you're my favorite reader of all time. Thank you. So yes, because Martin is, as I've already mentioned, he's an art critic. He has someone who has come from quite a simple suburban upbringing and has spent his whole life trying to escape that. And I think for him, the colour beige represents that soup of mediocrity, as he sees it, that he wants to get away from. And it represents his background, and it represents like the stultifying, semi-detached house that he lives in, that he hates, and the carpets and the gas fire. And he wants to belong to this bigger, more colourful, more exotic world of the rich and the elite and the people who actually will never make him feel welcome. And that begins this sort of lifelong love affair that ultimately is never redeemable. And I think, again, for him to find himself in the police room, the stuffy little police room, where they don't even know how to make a proper cup of tea and they're not treating him with the respect that he so desperately wants, and they don't care about his reputation, and they don't care about his wealthy friends. And there is this woman with beige hair, and he talks quite a lot about how angry he is with her, really. And he imagines her little life. And I think it does convey something for him. It's that kind of female figure of authority, represented also by his mother, who, again, he's just been trying to distance himself from.
Yes. Yeah. I wonder if you can talk a bit about building suspense, particularly when much is being held back, which I thought you did so well. And I think if it weren't handled correctly, you could lose a reader, because a lot is being held back. There's a lot that we have to wait for or put our trust in the writer to you know, unfold events as we need them. And yet you build suspense right from page one. So is there any observation you can make about that?
Thank you. I was worried about that. I was worried about whether the payoff would be worth the build up. And I think I was able to counteract that because of my training as a journalist. And as a journalist, you only have a short amount of time to make impact with your reader before they turn the page, or as is nowadays, click onto an item about Britney Spears or Kim Kardashian, or like a naked mole rat. So you only have a limited amount of time, and therefore your introduction has to grab the attention. And then you have to lead a reader through, say, 1,000 to 2,000 words of prose, and make sure that they are engaged at every single point, and make sure that every paragraph you write leads on to the next paragraph. And that, again, by the payoff, they feel that they've read something worthwhile, that it was worthwhile spending their time doing that. And I think that was tremendously helpful for me when it came to writing The Party, because I guess each chapter, I would have that structure in my head. So it wasn't just about the whole book being a build-up, an incident, and a conclusion. It was about each chapter having a build-up and a cliffhanger at the end. Right. And so that was something I was very aware of. Like, yeah, within the confines of every single chapter, there had to be something that led the reader on to the next bit, that posed some kind of question in their head, or that made them want to find out what happened next. And that's really about as sophisticated as I got with it. other than the fact that, you know, I did edits. There was probably more editing on this book. Was there? Yeah. I think the edits on this book, they weren't dramatic edits, but they were definitely ones that helped really hang the structure together. And I think they were very helpful. And what I did do was I left a few months between finishing the first draft and then tackling the edits. I left a period of time, I think it was about 3 months, and then I went away on holiday for a week and just like really blitzed them all. But I think that period of time was helpful, because you can then look at the manuscript with fresher eyes and you can see yourself what needs doing without being sort of stuck in it and without having that kind of immediacy. So that was also really helpful.
Okay. Now, if it's anything that you can address for people who haven't read the book yet, what changed most in your revision, would you say? What aspect of the book changed most or had to be addressed?
Actually, before I answer that, the other thing I wanted to say about the previous question.
Yeah.
The other thing that really helped me, and I'm this isn't even a joke, is watching a lot of television, a lot of Netflix, and those kind of big box set dramas, because I think they have become almost the new Dickensian novel for the modern generation, because they're multi-episodic and multi-stranded, and they have, you know, you look at something like Game of Thrones, and the minor characters are given just as much deference and attention as the major characters, and the result is this incredibly rich, woven tapestry of plot and character. And I think genuinely I learned quite a lot about suspense and pace and interest from those box sets, because again, Game of Thrones has sustained interest and suspense over seven seasons now. I think that's been really interesting for writers. So sorry, that was something I wanted to tag on to the previous answer.
No, that's
and
fine.
Then what changed most in revisions? There was a bit of explaining to do about Lucy, because there was some of Lucy's backstory that I put in, because I wanted to be able fully to explain why she was with Martin and what had happened in her life to lead her up to that point.
Okay.
So there's one particular incident. Again, I don't want to give it away, but it's something that happened to Lucy in her, what I would say, university days, and what you would say, is it college? College days.
Yeah.
but go some way in explaining that. So, and then the other thing that I revised, there's a character called Andrew Jarvis in The Party, who is a friend of Ben's from school, who Martin viscerally loathes.
Right.
Because for Martin, Andrew Jarvis represents what he'll never be, which is someone who is entitled and wealthy and born into that kind of society, and who therefore has access to Ben's friendship in quite a nonchalant way, whereas Martin constantly has to sort of try. And I made the character of Andrew Jarvis a bigger presence throughout the course of the novel. So he's a sort of talisman. You know, you know when Andrew Jarvis rears his head that things aren't going to go well. So I wrote an extra scene at school. In fact, the rugby scene that we talked about, where Jarvis appears. And there's an extra scene then in their 30s where he appears at a party. And then Andrew Jarvis comes up again at the party of the title. and towards the end of the book as well. He sort right. of, yeah, he sticks around like a noxious smell. So I made the character of him much bigger. But as for Martin, there wasn't actually much editing to do with him. I'd kind of nailed his voice.
Oh,
again,
that's so important.
Worrying.
Yeah.
And then, so it was mainly kind of Lucy and Jarvis. And then there were a few elements of the interaction with the police that just needed a bit of clarifying.
Okay. All right. I want to ask you another, I would call it a craft question. And that is, from time to time, you and a lot of other authors, though I've read, that will drop in things that seem important, but yet they don't make sense to us yet. So, for example, you drop in the name Keith. You know, the first time we encounter Keith, it's because Lucy in her notebook says that Keith said such and such, and we don't know who that is yet. Mm. And then also, sometimes memories are alluded to without being fully explained, and we're not familiar with them. One in particular is very, very important, and I won't say what that is. But when we read about that, we wonder, is that something that happened at the party, or is that from what happened, and when was it? So it's sort of dropping things in, like dropping a stone into a pond and letting those ripples move out to the reader kind of gradually. So I wonder if you can talk about how this enriches a narrative, or particularly maybe the suspense in this narrative.
Yeah, I think it's all part of what we were discussing earlier about drawing a reader in, mm-hmm. and ensuring that they have just enough information to keep their attention, but not too much to over-explain anything. And that adds to the kind of mysterious, I hope, quality of the text, because you're being offered these clues, really. And it's again, all part of an unreliable narrator offering you as the reader a clue that you can then store up and be reminded of later down the line. But I enjoy that as an author, because obviously there will be some things in there that might not have the resonance. And it's about, as a reader, being able to kind of store those things up and then remind yourself of that when there's a kind of literal echo of it later on in the narrative. I don't sort of plot those out in advance, but I know what's, obviously as the author, I know what's going to happen.
Right.
And therefore, when it feels appropriate as I'm writing in a character's voice, I might fit something in.
Yeah.
But I definitely, I don't sort of plot them out in terms of kind of spacing. It's just when it feels right, mm-hmm. instinctively, which is probably an unhelpful answer.
No. I mean, I think that's why it feels right to the reader too, because it's been dropped there organically by intuition rather than planned out. So
I hope so. Thank you.
Okay, Elizabeth, I wondered, what are you writing now? Have you started a new project?
Well, I've started a new project, but it's not fiction, because I am actually ghosting a memoir. She's a political activist in Britain called Gina Miller. She's a wonderful woman. I'm allowed to talk about it.
Okay.
And she took our government to court over our exit from the European Union, and she actually won her case. And she's fascinating. So I've been in the process of interviewing her and then just finishing the first draft. Actually finished it last week. So that's been fascinating, because I've had to assume someone else's voice and someone else's life story. And I actually think it's been really good training for me as a novelist. So the next thing I write will be a novel. And I have just started writing something that I'm very interested with what is happening with women right now, in terms of all the Harvey Weinstein stuff, all the kind of Me Too, the incredible kind of Me Too campaign, everything you've seen with, you know, Roy Moore's defeat in Alabama. Hooray for that.
I just
think it's a very interesting and weird and pressurized time to be a woman. And I really wanted to write about that, but I wanted to write about it from the perspective of maybe an older woman who sees herself as a sort of generation before all of this stuff has happened, and what that might mean for her and how she redefines her own life. So that's what I'm playing with at the moment.
Yeah, I feel like there's a whole generation of feminists who worked so hard and are sort of kind of like the lost feminists, you know, like I don't think they're given their due in what's in all the steps forward that we're taking right now. I don't think they always get their due.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
I totally agree. And I often think that they are, my mother's age, so sort of approaching 70, in their 70s. And a lot of the time they will have fought for gender equality. And yet they'll also have had to have been kind of mothers and wives and felt the duty and responsibility of having a family and often would have had to sacrifice their own ambitions because the world hadn't really caught up yet. And I just think that's a fascinating and also admirable but quite sad place to be sometimes. And I feel very grateful that I am the age I am, which I'm in my 30s, and I do think I've benefited so enormously from the battles fought on my behalf, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And also from the fact, you know, I was in an unhappy marriage and I was able to get divorced. And I think a lot of women didn't feel that was open to them.
Right.
I'm very grateful for that. And I do think, as you say, that it's just a really interesting age group. And I often think older women and angry women get overlooked in fiction.
Yes.
So that's something I want to look at.
Let's write some angry older women.
Yes, more angry older women.
I wanted to know if you've read anything lately that you would recommend to listeners.
Yes, I absolutely have. I read Lincoln in the Bardo, the George Saunders novel, which I thought was fantastic. I think he is a peerless writer of short stories. He's such a beautiful writer. And Lincoln in the Bardo is so highly original. I mean, one of the things that came up with the party, because the party, and I'm very open about this, was an homage in many ways to books like The Tanner, Mr. Ripley. Some people have called it, like, have said that it's not as original as it could be. And I sort of think, well, but isn't all literature informed by other literature?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
isn't that kind of fine? And what is originality anyway? And are there are only ever like 7 great stories on it. But I have to say, George Saunders, annoyingly, has redefined the novel form with Lincoln in the Bardo. And it's beautiful and profound and moving in this meditation on the human condition, as well as being really funny. So I love that. I've just finished Rebecca Solnit's collection of essays, The Mother of All Questions, which was great and just what I needed to read right now. And then I read this year a couple of amazing novels by female novelists. Anything is Possible by Elizabeth Strout. I think she's a beautiful, compassionate, observing writer. And that was the follow-up from My Name is Lucy Barton, although you don't have to have read it. And then the other one was Claire Massoud's The Burning Girl. Again, I love Claire Massoud. And she wrote a fantastic angry old woman in The Woman Upstairs.
The Woman Upstairs,
I remember people
saying, oh, you know, I remember there was all this media around the fact that people said they didn't like her protagonist. But as I read the book, I was sort of anticipating not liking the protagonist in The Woman Upstairs. And I'm like, what? She's fine. What's the matter?
Oh, I totally agree. And I actually hate this thing about likable and unlikable protagonists.
It's ridiculous.
On what planet do you, I mean, no one is ever wholly likable or unlikable. No one is ever wholly good or wholly bad. For me, the key thing is to make your protagonist interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still love a novel that has someone who acts in unsympathetic ways, because that's life.
Right. Well, and as you've said, there are things about Martin that are very unsympathetic. And yet I think that if you had swapped these narrators and Lucy was in that position, you'd be getting a lot more of that kind of comment.
That's so true.
Don't you think?
Yeah, I do think that. That's very, very true. And it's incredibly dispiriting. And I think it's because women, we still live in a kind of place of cultural sexism where if you show a woman being assertive, quite often she's depicted in other people's minds as bossy or shrewish.
Yeah.
Whereas men can be bold and assertive.
Right.
And that's only ever kind of managerial.
Right.
And I think the same thing happens with male and female authors, by the way. I think it's changing, thank goodness. This year has been a great year for for female writers. John Boyne, who wrote the Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, has been an enormous supporter of the party, and I love him for it. And he wrote this wonderful essay that got published in The Guardian yesterday about how he thinks that female writers are better than men, and how he's read 120 books this year in his top 10, the vast majority are written by women.
Did you read his latest
one? I did. I loved it.
I loved it.
Yeah, it's so
good.
Epic and sweet, and has such love for the characters.
Yes.
But I think the point that John was making in his essay, and something that I feel very strongly about, is that when female authors are observational, or they write about a family, then their novels are sort of described as domestic dramas and small scale. And when a man like Jonathan Franzen does it, and he writes about family, it's always about the human condition. That's how it's pitched. Right. He's such a great American novelist. And I find that very annoying.
I
think that the tide is changing.
Right. Yeah. Or else the term women's fiction, which is just sort of, dismissive.
Yeah.
If that were embraced, I wouldn't mind the term, but it's always in this dismissive sense.
Yeah.
All right. I have one last question for you, Elizabeth, and it gets back to what I was saying before about your descriptions of characters. I'm going to just, if I may, read one last little bit. This is Martin speaking about Ben's mother. This is the first time we've ever encountered any description of Lady Catherine. "I've heard so much about you," his mother, Lady Catherine, had said when we were introduced. "I shook her hand. Discreetly, she withdrew and wiped her palm on her calf-length skirt. You must make yourself at home here." So I always end my interviews by asking for advice for listeners who are writers. And I wondered if you could offer some advice about including relevant, vibrant detail that does more than just describe, that tells us about the characters that we're reading about, tells us something about who they are.
Gosh, it's so interesting being asked for advice by other writers, because it's such an honor, because I don't know, I never know whether I'm qualified, which I know is a ridiculous thing to say because I've written books. But I think with my first novel, Scissors, Paper, Stone, which should have been called Rock, Paper, Scissors, I was so thrilled to be writing fiction, having had years as a journalist where you're not really allowed to describe too much. I was so thrilled by the liberation that I think I possibly over-described, and I got really into simile and metaphor, and it was almost like the explosion of this build-up, and I wanted to put like everything into this novel that I was writing.
Yeah.
And I think that has its place, and I do really love descriptive passages when they're done well, but actually every novel since then I've written, I have understood more the power of a carefully chosen phrase and the power that comes from paring back and withholding. Mm. And really, my advice would be, when you're describing something, ask yourself, what does this description do? Because if it actively does something, if it increases our understanding of a character or a situation, or if it leads you into a past memory that helps you visualize a character better, or if it gives you a sense of a character's internal state of mind, their sense of rage, for instance, then it's worth doing. And then if you want to describe just for the sake of describing, that's also fine. But it's a bit like when you put on lots of clothes and accessories because you're excited that you're going out for a night, and I would advise you to look at yourself in the mirror, just as you would look at your clothes in the mirror, and to take maybe one or two things off, because you will look better and the sentence will look better too. And it's interesting that you earlier quoted that passage to me about Martin's mother saying goodbye to him at the train station, or rather not saying goodbye, because I remember one of my earliest readers, I was incredibly lucky to meet Sebastian Faulks through a friend of mine, and he unbelievably generously offered to read an early manuscript of the party and gave me some incredible notes. There weren't a lot of them, but they were so insightful. And I remember him telling me about that particular passage in the train station. I think I heard there was one too many words. I think I'd talked about how, I don't know, like her heels were low and dull and they were clickety-clacketing along the floor or something like that. And he was like, what would this sentence read like if you took out clickety-clack? And it read so much better. It read so much better. I don't know if it was clickety-clack, but it was something along those lines. And I think, again, if you just ask yourself as a writer, how would this sentence read if I took out this word? Because often it's the word that is the most cliched word in the whole sentence. Often it's the word that will describe enthusiasm as puppyish or, you know, and actually you don't need that. It's tautological. You can just call it enthusiasm. And just ask yourself with every sentence, like, would this read better if I took off this incredibly jangly, loud golden bracelet that I wanted to wear? So that would be my advice.
Oh, fantastic. That's wonderful advice. Thank you so much. I want to just mention again, the name of the book is The Party, written by Elizabeth Day, published in the U.S. by Little Brown and Company. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much. There were such great questions, and I just loved every minute of it. Thank you.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author and journalist Elizabeth Day. We discussed her novel, The Party, published in the U.S. by Little Brown. You can learn more about her work at elizabethdayonline.co.uk. So this is going to sound familiar because you just heard it in the interview. This week's Write the Book prompt is inspired by something that Elizabeth said in our interview. Have a look at the details in a scene you're perhaps struggling with and see if there are words that can come out or one aspect of detail. Ask yourself, how would this sentence read if I just took this word out or that embellishment? Often, as Elizabeth said in our interview, it's the most cliched word. Think of it as taking off a jangly, loud golden bracelet. I loved that analogy. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. Actually, next week, you're going to hear a couple reruns. Next week is Christmas Day, the Monday. So I'm going to run a couple of reruns. I think there are still prompts in both of those, though. So have a listen, and maybe they can help you with your work over the holiday. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And I say this every week, maybe this week I can ask you to make it a little holiday gift for me. If you like the show, please do go into iTunes and rate it or like it on Facebook. Maybe tweet about Write the Book. Tell all your friends. All right. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.